You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
So we've been notified that lockdown, in the United Kingdom at least, is going to continue for another 3 weeks, and perhaps 3 weeks after that, and so on into the indefinite future. We've been busy publishing various posts on the legal implications of this on the UK Human Rights blog, and today I have with me two of the authors of these posts. Coincidentally and interestingly, both Dominic Rutkeen and Dara Coffey were in the armed forces before deciding to turn to the bar. Welcome to LawPod UK, Dom and Dara. Dara, you explored in your two articles the general aims of the 2020 Coronavirus Act. Can you remind us what they are?
Thank you, Rosalind, and thank you for having me on the podcast. The 2020 Act forms a rather significant plank of the government's response to the coronavirus, but certainly by no means the only plank, as the lockdown regulations are in fact made under the Public Health Control of Diseases Act 1984, rather than the Coronavirus Act 2020. But the 2020 Act does contain a significant number of powers granted to the government. The main aims are set out in the explanatory notes that accompanied that legislation through Parliament, and they're fivefold. The first is to increase the available health and social care workforce. The second is to manage the deceased with dignity and respect. The third is to support people, to ease the burden on frontline staff. And then the final aim, and perhaps the aim that has the most significant impact on our daily lives, is the aim of containing and slowing the spread of the virus.
Can you explain why the movement restrictions contained in the regulations were made under the 1984 Act rather than the 2020 Act?
That's a really great question. And to be honest, I wish I could. It's a question that a number of other commentators have, in fact, posed on various blogs exploring the legality of those restrictions or otherwise. In fact, there were a number of legislative routes that could have been taken in order to put these lockdown restrictions in place. I suppose to give the regulations under which the restrictions are made their full title, it's the Health Protection Coronavirus Restrictions England regulations, and there are, in fact, similar regulations for both Scotland, Wales, and for Northern Ireland, which have basically the same effect. They could have been made under the Civil Contingencies Act 1984, which would seem to be legislation that's designed with exactly the sort of situation we currently have in mind, essentially that there's an emergency situation that requires extraordinary legislation. I suppose the issue there, and it seems the government's rationale behind not using that, was that under the Civil Contingencies Act, once regulations are made, they must be laid before Parliament within 7 days. And then those regulations will only have a lifespan of 30 days before they need to be renewed. In a situation whereby Parliament currently assembling as it traditionally would pose a rather significant infection and transmission risk, I suppose the government were of the opinion that that 30-day lifespan was simply insufficient. Now, I should mention that there were a number of commentators have suggested that this is not really a very strong argument. I know in the Law Society Gazette, Dr. Andrew Blick and Professor Clive Walker have suggested that that sort of doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, but it is the way that the government decided to go. In relation to the Coronavirus Act 2020, it's not really clear why the government didn't choose to go under those powers, because those powers would be available to the government under Section 51 and Schedule 21 and Section 52 and Schedule 22 of the Coronavirus Act, which allows very similar restrictions to be put in place.
Now, we've advertised on the blog and provided links to papers written by Lord Sandhurst QC and others. Lord Sandhurst was formerly Guy Mansfield of One Crown Office Row, now retired. And he and others make serious arguments that the movement restriction regulations and the powers of enforcement that are governing our lives at the moment are undermining and indeed threatening the rule of law. I'd like to know what both of you think of this, starting with you, Dom.
Thank you, Rosend. I think there are some very interesting points that are being raised about the regulations and the restrictions that they've imposed on all of us. Not least because there is the uncertainty about exactly why they were done under the 1984 Act as opposed to the Civil Contingencies Act or indeed under the Corona Act itself. And the primary starting point has to be that what the regulations have in effect imposed is detention upon the population. Now, that is a strong word, and detention is a strong word, but I think it is clear that when you look at the Supreme Court's ruling in Jolla in particular, that the definition of detention under common law is where you are prevented from leaving a particular place by someone else. That the Supreme Court said in Jolla, the methods that might be used to keep the person there are many and various. There could be physical barriers such as locks and bars. There could be physical people such as guards who would physically prevent the person leaving if he tried to do so. There could also be threats, whether of force or of legal process. The point is that person is obliged to stay where he is ordered to stay, whether he wants to do so or not. And in Jolla, which was a case about immigration and where there had been a curfew imposed, the Home Secretary had argued that imprisonment required constraint on freedom of movement by physical or human barriers, and that voluntary compliance with a request or instruction was not enough. And that argument was rejected by the Supreme Court. So the starting point, as I say, is that by saying we are not able to leave our own homes without reasonable excuse, then that is in effect detention. Now, that detention can easily be made lawful, provided that there is a legal basis for it. But that's what you have to have under common law in order for it to be not unlawful detention. And the doubts that have been raised by various commentators, whether Lord Sumption or indeed Lord Sandhurst, is the question as to whether the regulations themselves are ultra vires, so are lawful as a means to make what would otherwise be unlawful detention lawful. But there's a separate point as to whether under public law grounds, the policy and practice surrounding the implementation of the regulations is sufficiently clear and consistent to make that potentially unlawful detention lawful.
Now, there is an obligation on states to respect the right to life under Article 2 of the European Convention. What does this epidemic mean for this and the controls and protocols introduced by the government?
Article 2 understood to have two limbs to it. There's a systemic limb and also then an operational limb. And in general, the state is obliged to have a systems in place in order to ensure that Article 2 is protected, so the right to life is protected. And while initially the case law from the European Court of Human Rights and then the various national courts understood Article 2 to really be applying to where the state or agents of the state had themselves taken individuals' lives, that has gradually been eroded, and Article 2 is now more broadly understood to impose a requirement on the state to take both, as I said, to both have in place these systems, but also to have an operational duty, which means you're required to take reasonable preventative operational measures to safeguard lives against any real and immediate risks. And it's interesting that while, as far as I'm aware, the question of a pandemic itself has never been considered, there are cases, for example, Özel against Turkey, which considered environmental disasters over which states have no control. And in there, the obligation of the state was held to be taking preventative operational measures to reinforce its capacity to deal with the unexpected and violent nature of natural phenomena in order to reduce their catastrophic impact to a minimum. So that's a sort of overarching sort of duty to be prepared. And that clearly is potentially relevant to coronavirus, because there will be a degree to which the state was required to take appropriate preparatory measures in light of its knowledge about what might happen if there was another flu-like pandemic, in order to do with the potentially catastrophic impact of a pandemic. And we know that there have been consideration as to what might be required under a pandemic. And interestingly, the pandemic was one of the threats specifically considered under the debate before the Civil Contingencies Act. But there also appear to have been, as one might expect, sort of dry run exercises done by the government and in particular Public Health England and the NHS to try to model what a pandemic might look like and what the requirements would be for personal protective equipment, PPE, and so on. And so there may well be scrutiny through the courts at some point, and it's not quite clear yet as to the degree to which the courts would be happy to get involved in trying to scrutinise the government's preparedness for this. But there may be attempts to say, well, the government had an Article 2 duty to take necessary measures to prepare for such a pandemic, reasonable and appropriate measures. And of course, the courts will give a very broad discretion, marginal discretion to the government, because these are questions involving such interlocking and complex social, economic, scientific questions. But then also, with regards to Article 2 and the operational duty, there would be potentially issues around whether there were appropriate planning and procurement for PPE for NHS and other frontline key workers. And we see there is a real live political issue at the moment as to whether there is sufficient PPE, whether we could have done more to have bought PPE ahead to stockpile, whether we had done enough during the development of the pandemic to buy PPE at the appropriate moments, and so on. And I think the read across for me was the Iraq equipment claims that Smith and MOD, which I was involved with at the stage after the Supreme Court, had said, well, in principle, there could be an Article 2 duty applying to the procurement of protective military equipment. And I think the more that there is talk of a war on coronavirus, frontline workers, frontline protective equipment, that the more you could see a route by which an NHS worker would say, well, this is potentially a breach of my Article 2 if I'm not being supplied with the appropriate protective equipment. And then I think lastly, way that Article 2 could be relevant is that the Supreme Court has held on a number of occasions, in particular Rabone, that Article 2 does particularly apply to people in state detention. And so if you track through saying, well, are people currently in detention in a sort of informal, non-prison context, but nevertheless that we are restricted to our homes, then if there is a real and identified risk for particular groups from being in that detention or that lockdown, such as victims of domestic abuse or people with mental or physical health conditions which might deteriorate due to the lockdown, then there would be another question arising under Article 2 about whether appropriate measures have been taken in light of any identifiable real and immediate risk to life.
I think it's also quite arguable that given that the government are aware of the nature of this virus and the threat that it poses to people with underlying health conditions and the elderly, etc., I think there would be a reasonable argument that those people would be considered to be in a vulnerable position because of the nature of the pandemic being on the territory of the state, and also that the government are aware of measures that need to be taken in order to safeguard them against it. I'm not sure what Dom's view on this is. But I suppose that's a starting point for suggesting that necessity to put reasonable measures in place for those people's lives, those people in a vulnerable position's lives, starts as a justificatory position for imposing further lockdowns on other civil liberties or human rights that we would otherwise have more free rein in relation to. And that's where you get things like restrictions on freedom of association. So the ability to disperse or prevent gatherings, how you have restrictions on the freedom of movement. So again, coming back to this idea of locking down within people's homes, So that sort of balancing between the desire to protect life on one hand, again, we constantly hear the refrain on the TV and various other places, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Between that sort of an aspect and then those other civil liberties we're more used to having untrammeled in this country, certainly, it raises an interesting question in relation to those sort of balancing, which really, I think, has to be asked and has to be monitored to an extent.
I would agree. And I think you step back and you look at this in the broader context of this particular government has been quite vocal about the degree to which it is unhappy about what they see as judicial activism. And there was already ideas about reforming judicial review, about trying to restrict to some degree the extent to which the courts can, as the government or some within the Conservative Party would see as unjustified and unconstitutional politicisation of the courts. That would be a context which would be very much, I suspect, in the judiciary's minds were there starting to be legal challenges raised to either the government's policy pre, during and even post the pandemic in general and the lockdown in particular. And I think the courts would be very much wanting to try to give a margin of discretion to the government for what is an unprecedented situation. It's not an unprecedented scenario because this clearly was something which the government has and governments generally across the world have been aware might happen at some point. But nevertheless, how this actually plays out in practice is unprecedented. And across all the Western democratic countries, broadly speaking, with the odd outliers such as Sweden, have imposed extremely drastic lockdown measures. And when you look at the Article 2, or you're looking at deprivation of liberty and those balancing ideas which Dara was talking about, I think the courts would want to have a very broad range of discretion when it came to looking at the government's policies during the pandemic and the lockdown itself, because it's clear that there is different competing scientific models about what the epidemic is doing, how we should react to it. There are different competing economic arguments that are being made. There are different and competing medical opinions about how many lives are being affected and potentially lost as a result of people not suffering from coronavirus who aren't getting to hospital to have their cancer diagnosis or whatever. And those are such broad questions that I think when it comes to, you know, the court's willingness to try to assess those, that the government will be given, as I say, a great range of a margin of discretion. But I think the more specific a group you're talking about, the more real and immediate risk that is identified, the more willing a court may be to say, well, actually, there wasn't sufficient regard given to the risk to victims of domestic abuse or whatever it is. But it, in a sense, there would be that sort of funnel of willingness to engage. The broader the issue, the more competing policies within that decisions, in those government decisions, the less the courts are likely to want to interfere. But the narrower the point, the greater that willingness to interfere. And it's fair to say that the Supreme Court has said that just because the issue is political with a small p does not mean that the courts cannot be involved. In particular, you know, the Miller case in 2019 was a clear statement of that.
Well, I suppose just to come back quickly on that, you know, any court is going to be mindful of previous decisions that in their time were seen to be respecting the broad discretion of the executive, but then in later times were seen to be, you know, pretty terrible decisions. One thinks immediately of something like Liversidge and Anderson in the United Kingdom. Often it's forgotten that Lord Atkin's famous speech in that case was in fact a dissent. And similarly in the United States, you have things like the Korematsu decision. And I suppose courts always have to have in mind that when we're in the teeth of something like an emergency that we have now, it's often very easy to sort of defer to the executive and trample on the rights of others. And I think any court that's faced with questioning in relation to either whether these regulations are ultra vires or intra vires, or indeed whether they are compatible with Human Rights Act, because it must be borne in mind that the United Kingdom has not derogated like some states have chosen to under Article 15 of the European Convention. So the full gamut of human rights do apply. So any court analysing the compatibility of these regulations and the lockdown with those sort of aspects will likely be very careful and be very considered in how they balance the emergency against the rights population.
Yeah, it's interesting, the derogation, because in the Court of Protection, I think it was Hayden J. last month, held that even though there hadn't been a derogation, in his opinion, clearly there was an emergency such that a derogation would be entirely justifiable. And that was in a case about coronavirus and whether the restrictions were affecting someone's best interests under the Capacity Act.
It's interesting you raise that, and you previously raised the question of the provision of equipment in the Iraq conflict and how there were various cases. I think Smith and the Ministry of Defence brings to mind. And it's interesting to see that the government have not, because again, in that they had not chosen to derogate where they could be freed of certain constraints, obviously not specific Article 2 constraints, but certain other constraints that are often a cause for much gnashing of teeth when you hear people speaking about the constraint of the ability of the military to fight abroad because of the Human Rights Act. These can be essentially sidelined when there is a sufficient emergency or state of war declared. And it's interesting to see the state has not necessarily learned from being held to account over various aspects in Iraq because they didn't choose to derogate then, and deciding that they may derogate in these circumstances to give them slightly more leeway. Now, interestingly, any derogation must, of course, be only such as is proportionate and reasonable and necessary to meet the emergency and for the state to fulfill other obligations. But it is quite interesting that there was a decision made somewhere not to lodge that derogation, like at least, I think, six other Council of Europe states have so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Iraq equipment claims are interesting because I think they show how a court might start looking at questions under Article 2 or indeed perhaps common law negligence over provision of PPE. The further away from the heat of the moment the decision is, the more willing, in effect, a court is to look at it and say, well, this isn't a operational decision being made in the heat of the moment. And I think in this context, the decisions being made to send PPE to, you know, a hospital in Middlesbrough versus one to, you know, one in Liverpool, say, you know, a court's going to be very hesitant about engaging at that level of tactical, in effect, detail, because that is very much at the, you know, the heat of the moment. As I said earlier, I think where it's more interesting is the degree to which any current issues with PPE shortage could have been prevented by action taken prior to the pandemic itself. And the government's answer may well be, well, yes, of course we could have stockpiled a billion pieces of PPE, but that would have been at a cost of X hundred million a year to keep it in date, stored safely, replaced when it runs out of date, etc. And that's a resource decision which is ultimately too policy or too political for a court to engage in and say it's not justiciable. But Darrow, I would agree that, as you said earlier, you know, talking about the degree to which the courts would be willing to look at this, I think when, particularly if you're looking at it from the common law perspective, as opposed to the human rights aspect, as the Supreme Court said in Lumber in 2012, the right to liberty is of fundamental importance, and the courts should strictly and narrowly construe general statutory powers whose exercise restricts fundamental common law rights. And the rule of law calls for a transparent statement by the executive of the circumstances in which broad statutory criteria will be exercised. What must be published is that which with a person who's been affected by the operation of the policy needs to know in order to make informed and meaningful representations to the decision maker before a decision is made. And I think what we've seen earlier, and I think, Rosalind, you mentioned the guidance from the police has changed. It has become tighter. It has become more, perhaps more consistent, more able to be understood as to the circumstances that a reasonable excuse applies. And I think that was very necessary, because otherwise that does start raising more questions.
Article 5 of the European Convention is a very relevant provision in this period of lockdown. To what extent do you think the exceptions to Article 5 will save the government from actions under the Human Rights Act?
Article 5, of course, is everyone has the right to liberty and security of the person. And as you rightly allude to there, Rosalind, there are a number of exceptions within it. But I think, in fact, with the regulations as currently drafted, we come even before the question of whether an exception applies, and we actually ask whether Article 5 itself applies. Now, the two potential human rights that could be engaged here under the Convention would be Article 2 of the Fourth Protocol of the Convention, which guarantees the right to freedom of movement. Now, interestingly, the UK has not signed up to the Fourth Protocol, so that doesn't apply. So the only applicable right in UK law under the Human Rights Act is Article 5. And Article 5 is concerned with deprivations of liberty as opposed to mere restrictions. And the main case in that regard, or one of the main cases in that regard, is the Grand Chamber's decision in Di Tommaso and Italy. And they refer to a deprivation, whether something is a deprivation or a restriction of liberty, as being a matter of degree or intensity. And it can be contextually understood. So if you were to apply that to the present situation, we have a lockdown, the measures they're imposed so as to prevent the spread of a global pandemic. There is this idea of the protection of life under Article 2 that comes into play, and the fulfillment of the state's positive obligations. And rather than confining people at home, these regulations prohibit people from leaving without a reasonable excuse. And the regulations, of course, have a non-exhaustive list of examples here. Now, what the regulations don't do is they don't impose a temporal curfew on people that you must be at home by 8 p.m., and they don't impose a geographic limit. So, for instance, I know under similar Irish regulations, there is a limit of 2 kilometers around your home in which you may exercise. No such geographical limit exists in the UK regulations. And also, these regulations must be reassessed on a three-week basis. So, as we know, we've recently got a refreshment of the regulations. That means there'll be another 3 weeks and then potentially another 3 weeks after that. But the key point is these regulations must be reassessed at least every 3 weeks. Now, I suppose it's my view that in those circumstances, when you consider the degree and intensity of these restrictions and the context that they sit in, that is likely to be seen as a restriction of liberty rather than a deprivation for the purposes of Article 5. So I would consider that Article 5, on that view, is not actually engaged as of yet, certainly by the restrictions as drafted. Now, whether the restrictions as they are enforced or as they're policed become a deprivation under Article 5 is another question.
Do you think there are going to be common law actions, civil law actions, regarding overzealous, almost vigilante type behaviour, not just by the police, but by civilians during the course of this crisis?
I think it's a very difficult one to say. I am aware of at least one case already in Newcastle, where a lady was in Newcastle railway station and was arrested by British Transport Police for loitering between the platforms, and indeed brought before a district judge in the magistrate's court and was charged with this, interestingly, under the Coronavirus Act 2020 or regulations made thereunder, when no such regulations were in fact in force. And I believe it was Kirsty Bramlow QC and a number of others brought attention to this. And in fact, there was a flip rule applied and the conviction was overturned. So I think it's already been the case that there has been some, I think it's likely to be a minority, overzealous policing or overzealous application, perhaps. But I think, as Dom has previously said, the guidance that's now been issued to the police has been tightened up and should be of greater assistance to them now. And I should caveat that I don't mean to be in any way critical of the police in this regard, because ultimately these regulations have come in very quickly. They're now dealing with newly made law and trying to apply that in a very fast changing and indeed unfamiliar situation in relation to the lockdown. We have a tradition in the United Kingdom of consent-based policing, and I'm certain the police want to uphold that as much as they possibly can. So I do sympathise with officers who are given new guidance and expect to apply it immediately, but that's not to say that it should excuse the trampling on the ordinary rights of individuals.
I would agree with Dara that the police were put in a very difficult position. In a sense, they were being expected to join the gap between the regulations, which simply say you can't leave without reasonable excuse and give a non-exhaustive list of what reasonable excuses are, and at the same time, politicians making various statements and being asked various hypothetical scenarios, which the answers that they were given now are not legally binding because a politician's statement is not law, but did they amount to a policy, a public policy, which obviously starts biting in common law terms if you're saying there's a clear and consistent public policy that the government should therefore be bound by. And the police are, as Dara says, in a sense, having to not quite make this up on the spot, but they're having to apply a regulation to the daily lives of 65 million people. And you know, the reasonable excuse is a known term in law. I mean, it comes up in the Firearms Act, etc. But there's an entire body of case law that surrounds it and how that's been interpreted over the years, that the police don't have that in these situations. So they were faced with quite a challenge. But I think, Rosalind, to also pick up on your point as to whether there could be any common law actions arising against people who, in a sense, have snooped or vigilante sort of activities. I think there'd have to be a distinction made between if I look over the garden fence and ring up the police and say that my neighbour's left the house three times a day and has returned with decorating equipment, which is clearly for renovation rather than for maintenance, which seems to be, that's the new distinction being drawn in the latest police guidance, and the police turn up and take action. Ultimately, I don't think that there will be a duty of care between me and my neighbour to ensure that the police respond in an appropriate way. If I was the one who decided that I was going to interfere with next door and I stood in front of their doorstep and said, I'm not going to let you out because you've already been out twice today, then it would be me who was unlawfully detaining my neighbour, and there would be potentially a common law action against me.
It goes without saying that all the cases, regulations and laws that you've referred to in the course of our discussion, I will put the full citations and references in the blog post that will accompany this podcast when it goes out. Thank you very much, Dom and Dara, for coming on LawPod UK to discuss this important and pressing issue.
Thank you, Rosalind.
Thank you very much for having us.